terms of talking about the global financial crisis, which I'm not going to call the GFC, despite, you know, my affinity with Kevin Rudd after his $950. Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot to cover. So what I basically want to narrow it down to is to talk a little bit about some of the scale of the crisis, because I think it's important still to go over some of that ground, which I think is largely still contested, about just how big the crisis actually is. Then talk a little bit about the ideological repercussions of the crisis and some of the crisis, I guess, of neoliberalism, and also along with that, which we'll talk a bit about in the next session in an Australian context, the re-emergence of social democracy. And then finally talk a little bit about the the challenges to capitalism that are coming at different levels and the ways people are perceiving those challenges, and I guess the promise for struggle in the coming year. And I think just by way of introduction, it's worth kind of reflecting on what a difference a year makes. I mean, last year at our founding conference, we talked a little bit about the financial crisis that was brewing, but it was still largely contested in the mainstream media that there even was a crisis coming. And I think, you know, obviously now it's definitely uncontested. We're in the middle of a very large crisis and we haven't seen the back of it. And some of the effects as well that has had. I mean, we've seen the back of, you know, in Australia, Howard, we've seen the back of Blair in Britain, seen the end of Bush and the Republicans in the US. And obviously, I'll talk a little bit more about some of the other ramifications around the world. People may have seen that Iceland, the government in Iceland has actually fallen as a result of the economic crisis. And I think that's really the first government to have fallen straight and kind of unequivocally on the back of the crisis. And I think we can expect to see some more of that. And I think if you're looking at the world today, it's a very different place from 12 months ago, even from a few weeks ago, in terms of the landscape, the economic landscape, and what that means for the political landscape as well. So just in terms of starting by talking a little bit about the scale of the crisis, I want to start by talking a bit about what's kind of old ground now in terms of the collapse of the finance sector, because I think for a long time, you know, mainstream economists, politicians actually wanted to confine the crisis to what they call the financial sector and what they want to divorce from what they call the real economy. And obviously it is worth reflecting. I think it's, you know, a few months since we've seen a major collapse of financial institutions, like we were getting kind of every couple of days for a while there. But nonetheless, I mean, the credit crunch, which, you know, really kind of accelerated during 2008, had such an amazing effect on the financial sector globally. I mean, we had the collapse of Lehman Brothers, probably the biggest name firm that any government actually let collapse. But with that collapse, I think for a lot of governments came the knowledge that this wasn't actually something they could just sit by and watch, that there actually had to be a shift in policy to actually intervene. And people have read Chris Harman's article in the new issue of the ISJ. He talks about the US $1 trillion that governments have actually pumped into the financial sector to prop up ailing banks and ailing other kind of companies. I won't go, you know, too much into the detail of all of this, but, you know, just mentioning the names of, you know, big banks and companies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, AIG, the insurance company, Citibank, Northern Rock, like the names of the massive financial institutions that have either been bailed out or let collapse, I think, you know, are going to be burnt into the memory of all of us for a long time. Where we're at now in terms of the spread of the crisis, I think, is very telling, because there's absolutely, you could not argue that it has not spread to the real economy now. We've seen, you know, obviously a large push to say that it was going to be quarantined to this financial sector, but there's no argument now. I mean, we're seeing reports of literally millions of jobs have been shed worldwide. And now we're seeing kind of jobs in the productive sectors actually lining up for government handouts. I mean, the most notable worldwide, both here, the US and other places, has been the car manufacturing sector. There's a lot of pressure on the last days of the Bush administration to actually bail out the auto sector. It's something Obama's having to deal with in the early days of his administration. I'll go into unemployment figures in a minute, but it's certainly growing, and I think one thing that we've seen over the past couple of months has been rising factory closures in China in particular, which is something that for a long time people argued wasn't going to happen, and in fact was going to save a lot of developed economies, particularly Australia was the big example here. And you know, I'll come back to this at the end, but we're certainly not at the bottom of the crisis. This is only going to continue to spread over the coming few months. So I just want to talk a little bit about some of the impacts on national economies, which is still largely how it's measured. You want to talk about governments that have either acknowledged that they're in recession or there's speculation that they are in recession. And I'm only going to run through the big big names or the most relevant ones. The list is very long at the moment, but that the US, the UK, Germany, Italy, Ireland, Denmark, New Zealand, Japan, the list is very, very large and kind of growing every day. And that's just governments that are in technical recession. The other most notable thing, and I just talked a little bit about the recent closures of factories in China, has been the contraction of growth in the kind of rapidly growing economies. So China and India are the most notable, but you know, in this region, you can talk about Indonesia, has seen a contraction of growth in recent times, and I think that's going to be the case for a lot of the developing economies. Another kind of case, I was reading The Guardian on the way up here, talking about Eastern Europe, where you've had, it's obviously 20 years since the collapse of the Berlin Wall, etc., this year, and what you're seeing in the economies in Eastern Europe, you've got complete contractions in growth. Latvia by 10%, Estonia 7%, Lithuania 4.5%. There've been a lot of demonstrations in those countries, which we'll go into later on. But yes, it's pretty much the global picture in terms of either contraction, falling into recession, or contraction of growth. And I think some of the latest figures about the global projections are the first time that all these sustained contraction in the global economic system over a number of years is coming. And the obvious corollary of this, and the thing which tends to get separated off from this in the, you know, one's in the business pages, the other is buried somewhere else in the newspaper, is job losses and what it means for the, you know, the masses of people across the world. As I said, you know, we've seen millions of jobs lost globally over the last 12 months, and it's only going to increase over the coming months. You know, just a couple of figures. I mean, we've seen that the Rudd's now projecting another 300,000 job losses here over the next 12 months. We've got figures like 800,000 over the coming 3 months in the Philippines. Other people have been following in China. It's now said that whilst the government is saying it's about 10 million, that real figures are looking more like 20 million workers actually being sent from the major cities back to the countryside because the construction, the bottom's falling out of the construction industry and there are no jobs. So, I mean, the mind boggles that a figure of 20 million people actually being unable to find work anymore and being sent back to the countryside. So I guess that's a very brief survey of the state of things globally, and I think, you know, it's quite a stark picture in terms of the contraction of growth and what that then means for people in terms of their lives, you know, being employed, being able to get work. And I just want to move on to talk a little bit about what this has meant ideologically in terms of the kind of context over how to deal with the crisis and what's to blame for the crisis. And I think the first thing to say is that we've heard a lot about the death of neoliberalism. We've had major economists who for a long time have been opponents of neoliberalism proclaiming that it's dead. We've had figures like Sarkozy, who people would equate with the kind of neoliberal program in Europe, actually saying that neoliberalism is dead. And I think whilst, you know, I'll add some caveats to this in a moment, that we have seen actual changes in the actions of governments around the world. They actually, as I mentioned earlier, they have had to intervene where they've previously championed the kind of unfettered run of the free market, even though it was never really a reality. But nonetheless, they've had to intervene in a way that they haven't for a very long period of time, propping up banks, propping up the financial sector. And this creates a huge contradiction. I mean, it's led to the kind of disavowal in the media, etc. Because, you know, it's stark for everyone to see that these are the people who've pushed a program of, you know, the government staying out of business, staying out of production, out of finance, etc. And then governments having to step in to the tune of US $1 trillion. It's obviously creating a massive tension. And I think, whilst, you know, I think people have been saying it's the end of neoliberalism, there are huge contradictions in government's actions. On the one hand, they have intervened. On the other hand, we've still seen a lot of the measures of neoliberalism, such as pushing for wage restraint for workers, you know, pushing for certain types of social spending at the expense of other. There are huge contradictions in government's actions, and I think that's something that we need to keep an eye on. But at the same time, we've also seen a return of Keynesianism as a kind of, you know, ideology for the ruling class, and also as a way of kind of boosting and returning to social democracy. And we'll talk about that, I think, in the next session a bit more. But nonetheless, I think, you know, the action of a lot of, particularly in the developed world, of bailouts for institutions, of pump priming, cash handouts, talks of the New Deal in the US under Obama, these types of measures have created a completely different ideological climate to the one that was around 12 months ago in terms of what's up for grabs, what people are expecting of governments, and indeed the kind of language that governments are using. At the same time, I think it's worth returning to the kind of contradictions, because on the one hand you have this supposed rejection of neoliberalism, on the other hand you have a particular type of social spending. So you have social spending and government intervention to bail out banks, but you don't necessarily have government intervention and social spending to actually bail out the workers and the working class in that situation. So there continue to be contradictions in government's actions, and part of our job is to actually point to those contradictions and to actually attempt to push further along. But the final most important thing to say about the ideological repercussions of the crisis is to actually talk about the fundamental question for us, which is the system of capitalism itself actually being thrown into question. And I think this is obviously where we have a role to play that isn't being played by the mainstream, left. And I think, you know, obviously we can point to the immediate causes of the crisis, whether it's the subprime, mortgages, etc., and the immediate effects in terms of job losses. But where we differ is obviously a fundamental understanding of the fact that crisis is a part of capitalism as a system, that it's inherent to the system. And that is an argument that we actually have to look to be able to make to people. Now, obviously, you know, it can be made in various types of ways, one of which is quite crudely by the sections of the far left, in terms of, you know, almost that crisis is an exciting thing for the far left, as opposed to something that is, you know, obviously affecting the livelihoods and the, you know, lives of ordinary people, and it's something we actually have to look and make arguments to governments to mitigate the effects of it, etc. But at the same time, you know, fundamentally we need to actually be looking for ways to advance the argument that it is only actually once we get rid of capitalism as a system that we can hope to live without these kind of cycles of crisis, etc. And I think, you know, we want to discuss over the weekend various ways of actually intervening to make those arguments an opportunity. But I think that is obviously fundamentally how we look at the crisis, and also how we look to intervene around the crisis from that perspective. I just want to use the last kind of 8 minutes that I have to talk a little bit about some of the challenges to the kind of, you know, the effects of the crisis being pushed onto the working class in particular, and the kind of direction that this challenge can actually take. And the first thing I think when looking at the global political picture is obviously to talk about some of the figures that are stepped into the limelight or being thrust into the limelight on the back of people's opposition to the way that the crisis was actually being borne out in the early days. And I think the most obvious case study is Obama. And I think, you know, if you want to look at a political figure that has really captured the public mood around the crisis and the effects of the crisis, you need to look no further than Obama. He, you know, benefited hugely from people's disaffection with Bush's program over 8 years in the US. I mean, obviously there were other political questions as well, but I think it's the crisis that absolutely cemented the election team at the expense of McCain. And once, obviously, we have a critique of Obama, and I think it's very easy to see the limitations of his economic program. You only have to look as far as the kind of figures he has around him. Warren Buffett is always the first one that springs to my mind, who says he's this kind of go-to man on economics. But nonetheless, the expectations that people have already been played out in the early days of the Obama administration, and it's the kind of creative tension between what people believe Obama is going to deliver and the reality, the limited reality of what Obama is going to deliver, that actually provides some impetus for making further demands, not only in the US, but I think also around the world. I mean, it was mind-boggling to me. I was recently travelling, and just the amount of Obama mania that is everywhere. In Melbourne, there's like ice cream shops selling Obama ice cream flavours and stuff. Like, it's not just a problem of the US. It goes around the globe, and I think it's something we're going to have to continue to deal with. But nonetheless, I think it's erring on the side of pushing that creative tension rather than actually just blaming Obama still at the moment. The second kind of figure that I want to point to, and it's something that we haven't discussed as much as I think we should have in recent times, is the figure of Chavez in Venezuela. And he's starting to get a little bit more publicity again at the moment, the 10th year of his rule. But I think, you know, obviously we have a critique of Chavez's rule in Venezuela and the limitations of the rule, but I think it's something we need to keep an eye on, as, you know, he has been viewed as presenting an alternative to capitalism, an alternative, particularly during the Bush era. But the contradictions of the crisis are actually going to affect Chavez in a particular way as well. The falling oil price, when he's relied on oil revenue to actually deliver a lot of the reforms that he has delivered in Venezuela, this is going to, you know, present a challenge for Chavez and present a challenge for the left in Venezuela of how to actually deal with the changing economic situation in Venezuela. And I think it's going to force the left within Venezuela itself to actually confront the limitations of Chavez and Chavez's government. So, you know, I think it's definitely worth keeping an eye on that in terms of how the crisis is going to play out and what has been seen as an alternative to the kind of Bush era. The second element I wanted to talk about in terms of the challenges to capitalism under the crisis is the struggles of the streets, and obviously this has a particular importance for us. People who have been following in the media, particularly in France, over the last week, we've seen 2 million plus people on the street and workers from a whole range of industries out on the street. Out on the streets, which caused Sarkozy to say France is a difficult country to govern, which I thought was a very interesting take on things, and an encouraging take on things. Of course, after and just before Sarkozy was elected, there were massive demonstrations around issues of immigration and labour and various questions. And I think we can look, particularly in Europe, there's going to be these flare-ups and struggles, and we, you know, it's obviously very encouraging from our perspective, but The second kind of place in which we've seen those flare-ups has been in Greece. Obviously, we saw the riots after the police shot dead that teenager, and the riots very much took on a flavour of protest to how the government was handling the economic crisis. And in the last few days, there have been farmers actually blockading roads all over Greece. They've isolated Athens and shut down 3 of the borders of Greece, demanding greater compensation for falling commodity prices. So there's been a real kind of effort in that sense to actually look for ways to link the different elements of struggle around the economic crisis and look for ways to link it around Europe. We've seen protests at the World Economic Forum, been protests in Italy, and large demonstrations across Asia. When we were in Indonesia recently, there were very large spontaneous demonstrations and strikes as the government attempted to basically introduce a wage cap. And they reversed it within 2 weeks through a series of strikes around Indonesia. And I think it's not an isolated example. Something which I think is encouraging for us has been mass street demonstrations in China, which, as a result of what I was talking about earlier, the rapidly rising unemployment and disaffection is the government's response to that. The final thing I wanted to raise on the question of street demonstrations, because I'm sure it's going to come up sometime this weekend in the debate that's been happening on the email, which has been the strike in Britain, which, as I said, I don't want this to dominate the discussion if at all possible, but nonetheless, we want to open up space for it. And essentially what we have been a wildcat strike, and the main message that has been coming out of those strikes has been one of British jobs to British workers. And I think what those strikes really show to us, and certainly what the SWP has been arguing, which from what I can tell I largely agree with, has been that this is a perfect example of how in a time of crisis, if the left is not strong enough to actually provide an ideological leadership and a political leadership on the ground, actually things can be pulled very quickly to the right. And I think, you know, the British, the BNP has sent 800 people down to the pickets of these workers to actually support them. Obviously, we've heard all about the BNP in the past, and I think it's a good example of how things, when the left isn't able to actually take control and actually give expression to workers' struggles to actually maintain their jobs, that they can be pulled into the right, and in this case, in a racist direction. And I think that's something we need to actually keep in mind in our activity, and we need to be clear about the politics of struggles as they are taken up under the crisis. Which I think leads me neatly into the last kind of thing I want to say about the questions and responses to the crisis, because I think fundamentally what I've talked about here is the kind of creative tensions that are opened up under the crisis, and the fact that there are huge opportunities for the left to actually take up arguments that have been largely seen so far out of reach over recent times. I mean, you read article after article about Marx being embraced again in the newspapers, about Marx walking off the shelf in the bookshops, about people actually looking for answers as to why this crisis is occurring and what kind of different opportunities there are. That being said, I think obviously we need to keep an eye on firstly the weakness of the left. Australia is a particularly stark example, but I think it is reflected globally. When the left is not able to actually articulate a strong political response to the crisis and to actually pose an alternative on the ground, because there are huge dangers of the working class suffering and suffering very badly as a result of the crisis. And not just in the sense that obviously it will manifest in people's jobs, etc., but also as I raise the spectrum of racism and other kinds of manifestations of the right kind of politics under the crisis and when people are looking for answers. So I think concluding a moment as to what I think that actually means. But I think, you know, the kind of opportunities that are opened up for us, I mean, the classic example I think here has been around arguments of wage, about wage restraint, which rather has been pushing very hard wage restraint, which opens an opportunity for us to actually make an argument about the very political nature of wage campaigns in this environment, and to actually see that any wage campaign that is going far above inflation increases in wages is actually making a political argument that workers will not pay for the crisis. Okay, I'll just wind up. So I think by way of conclusion, I want to talk about two things. Firstly, what's going to happen, and secondly, kind of introduce a discussion about what we need to do about it. The first thing in terms of what is going to happen is very brief. It's going to get worse. I don't think at any point I'm actually sitting here and speculating how much worse it's going to be. And in the last day, again, quotes Connolly saying the only true profits are those who carve out the future. And I think the more important discussion for us to be having is how we actually respond to the crisis rather than speculating about how much worse it's going to get. Although I think we can comfortably say it is going to get worse. I mean, it is worth actually saying that, you know, within an Australian context in particular, that Rudd's attempts to actually end the crisis are largely futile. So just finally, by way of introducing a discussion about what we do about it, I think that, I mean, we have a weekend to discuss our various responses and the next session particularly to discuss the Australian context, but I think, I mean, the motion that I'm reading, which hopefully people have read, talks about the way in which the global financial crisis is going to underpin everything in the political sphere over the coming 12 months. And we need to be able to, basically we need to be in the front foot. I think we've done this well in some cases and badly in others over the last 6 months or so, but we need to look for ways to actually intervene in the debates, whether it's around Rudd's spending package, whether it's around the more ideological kind of debate that he outlines in the monthly, now I've written in a monthly about the resurgence of social democracy. And the main kind of tools for which are obviously going to be the magazine, our meetings, our leaflets, those types of tools of intervention. Secondly, I think we need to be looking for ways to respond to particular manifestations of the crisis where possible. And the most recent example has been the collapse of the ABC childcare stuff, where it's an example of how the global financial crisis actually affects people in terms of jobs, in terms of, you know, a basic right like childcare. And actually looking for ways to both respond to that, you know, in terms of literature, et cetera, but also looking to draw together like an activist response to those things. And the final thing I want to say is that I think, I mean, we kind of say this often, that the most important thing is the clarity about politics, but I think obviously we're a small group of people. We're not leading kind of struggles on the streets in this sense. But what we do have is an understanding of why the crisis is happening, and actually an argument about a way forward and a way to actually challenge, you know, the effect that it's having on people. And I think we need to look for every opportunity to actually find those ideas and actually discuss and debate and raise the political level around those ideas. And that's the role that I think we actually have to step up. I actually think there's a big responsibility on us as an organisation to actually step up on a national level and actually participate in and lead and shape those debates, because I think that leadership isn't coming from anywhere else, and it's kind of incumbent upon us to actually play that role over the coming 12 months. So, yeah.
Thank you.